For the past 40 years, Nicholas Kristof has written for the New York Times as a foreign correspondent, as a bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo, and as a columnist. In his new book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, he provides a candid look at his work, the lessons he's learned, and why good journalism remains so important to our democracy. Nick joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves from his home in Oregon's Willamette Valley to let us stow away with him on a typical day on the road as a foreign correspondent. Nick, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
So you have had an amazing career with the New York Times over 40 years. Can you just give us a quick review of what went on in that 40 years?
Yeah, I started out in New York covering kind of boring stuff. My beat was exchange rates, this kind of thing. And then I was a correspondent in Los Angeles, then a bureau chief in Hong Kong, a bureau chief in Beijing, bureau chief in Japan, and, you know, began to travel the world in that period, then became a editor briefly, and then have been a columnist since 2001, covering, you know, the world again, every corner of it.
So basically, the first half of the career was for a foreign reporter overseas.
That's correct.
And the last half was opinion columnist. For the first half, you had to report, and for the last half, you've been opining.
That's correct, yeah.
What do you like better?
You know, I do like the opining because I think that often gives me another layer which I can help provide meaning to readers. But I do think that the most important thing of my work, even if I'm an opinion columnist, is the reporting, not just the opinion.
Yeah. And you have a lot to report on in your book. I mean, what a page-turner. I don't use that word very often, but your book is a page-turner.
Maybe
it's because it's mostly travel, and I love travel so much, but this is crazy travel. This is extreme travel, what you do, but there's a lot of similarities. And what I would like to do, there's one chapter in your book, Chasing Hope, that's kind of like a day in the life of a foreign correspondent. And I'd love to just take a look at that for our travelers who are listening now. And this is the typical day in the life of you when you're out on the road, not on vacation. First of all, you wake up, and you did this chapter as a kind of a collection of experiences from different places, but generally, there's kind of a soundtrack when you're in a foreign land of when you're waking up. What happens?
Well, that's particularly true in Muslim countries where you hear the call to prayer. And, you know, I lived in Egypt for a year studying Arabic, and I remember the first day or two in my apartment, I just like bolted out of bed with the first call to prayer. And then, you know, after I got used to it, I just slept right through it.
Well, it is early. I think the first call to prayer, part of the words is, it's better to pray than to sleep.
And yeah, that's exactly right.
And I believe that Muhammad, before in the days of alarm clocks, Muhammad would say, when you have enough light to distinguish between a dark hair and a white hair on your arm, then it's light enough to get up. So that was the moment. So you got the call to prayer. It's usually one minaret and then a cacophony of minarets, isn't it?
Exactly right.
And then dogs start howling.
That's right. And people start moving, and then, you know, the vehicles start honking, and you kind of give up on sleep.
And then you untangle yourself, you said. What are you tangled up in when you sleep?
Well, I tend to use a sheet sack if I'm concerned about bed bugs. I had a bad encounter with bed bugs in Central African Republic, and I'm still a little traumatized by it. Mm-hmm. So I try to inspect for bed bugs, and then I use a sheet sack to try to reduce the prospect that I'll
And this is a silk
in.
Sleep sack you mentioned.
I'm into that, right.
Because I spent many years as a youth hosteler using sleep sacks because you had to provide your own sack. And does a silk sleep sack really protect you from bed bugs?
Well, it has me. I haven't done a randomized controlled trial, but I don't think a bed bug could get through it.
Right.
And
that's good.
It's very, very light. You know, it means that you don't have other things next to your body, next to your clothes that might take it home.
Then you don't need to complain about dirty sheets. You got your own.
That's exactly right. And they're a silk sheet sack is just so light.
Yeah.
You know, it's yeah. 2 or 3 ounces, so it's easy.
And then, of course, a mosquito net.
And then a bed net. I've had malaria a couple of times. You don't want to get it. And the malarial mosquitoes primarily bite just at night. And so if you can protect yourself at night, then that makes all the difference. You want to ideally have a bed net that has been treated with insecticide that mm-hmm. reduces the likelihood that the mosquitoes will come. And also, if I'm enveloped in a sheet sack and maybe a bed net, then rats are a little less likely to come, you know, like crawling over me. And there's nothing more disgusting than being woken up by a rat crawling over you in the middle of the night.
No, I would imagine, although I've never had that that delight. Wow. Nicholas Kristof has won Pulitzer Prizes for his columns on Darfur and for his coverage of China. He's with us today on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about his career as a reporter and foreign correspondent, which he writes about in his book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. You can also find out about his family farm in Oregon's Willamette Valley, where they're making cider and wine, at KristofFarms.com. Okay, so you're untangled from your mosquito net and your bedsheet, and the crows and the colder air has woken you up. You got to brush your teeth.
Yeah, you always have clean water with you. If you don't, then you want to make sure you bring some, you know, iodine tablets or some some way to purify water. You certainly don't want to get sick in the middle of nowhere.
You mentioned you went to sleep with your headlamp on because generally you'd have no electricity.
Yeah, my headlamp, not on in the sense of the light being on, but it's on my forehead so that if I need to wake up, there's some crisis, then, you know, I'm not fumbling around trying to find it. So I just leave my headlamp on my forehead when I sleep. On the theory that there's probably going to be no electricity there.
So if there's no electricity and no decent water and worry of rats crawling over you at night, I bet it's tough to get a good cup of coffee right out of bed.
You know, I don't have a lot of other foibles. I am an addict for coffee. I believe deeply in a cup of coffee in the morning. And so the night before, I try to figure out if there's going to be some coffee somewhere. And sometimes, you know, Ethiopia and Eritrea both have amazing coffee, even in, you know, in small places. Mm-hmm. But that is often not true. Because of the risk of not getting a good cup of coffee, I do take chocolate-covered coffee beans with me on trips. And they do make something of a substitute if you are a coffee addict.
So that gives you the same hit that a cup of coffee does.
Yeah, it helps wake me up in the morning.
Nice. Well, that's actually good to know. And then I can't really start the day without a shower. I don't know how people do. In a lot of war-torn places and sad corners of this planet, you know, there's just no running water. And oftentimes where you're working, there'd be no water. What generally would you do for a shower?
you don't take one. You know, sometimes every 2 or 3 days, maybe there'll be someplace where you can pour water over your, there'll be a kind of a bucket shower kind of thing where you just pour water over yourself. You know, a little bit nervous about what might be in that water, parasites, but one has to be clean. So I do that, but that's almost never a morning thing, partly because the water is probably going to be cold. It tends to be a late afternoon thing for me.
Is that usually like a big barrel of water with a scoop in it that you just can kind of douse yourself out? So
that's
for a
exactly
lot of people,
right.
That's their shower, and it's a couple times a week or something. And then you mentioned you don't get the day started without emailing home. What was the purpose of that?
So that's partly for security. So I want people at the New York Times to know that I am starting out from this location. I plan to go to that location. Mm-hmm. And nowadays we're getting much better at security and we can have devices that provide a track for us. You know, we can be located more easily. Security is something I take very seriously, partly because I've lost too many friends along the way. And if I try to have two vehicles so that if one, you know, runs into trouble and you're not lost in the middle of nowhere. I try to make sure I have lots of water. If we do have two vehicles, we have a walkie-talkie back and forth so that if the first one goes out to a checkpoint and the second one hangs back so that if something bad were to happen at the checkpoint, the second one can leave and can report what happened. And it also, I think, dissuades people at a checkpoint from, you know, killing or robbing somebody if they know that there's a witness in another vehicle that can escape.
Wow, this is Travel with Rick Steves. We're learning some extreme travel tips from Nicholas Kristof. He's just released a memoir about his life as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. His new book's called Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, and Nick gives vivid accounts of lessons learned from traveling into major conflict zones and into nearly every corner of this world. His opinion column appears twice a week in the New York Times. Okay, Nick, so you're ready to head off to work, and one thing I noticed is you take your luggage with you, even if you're not checking out of the hotel.
That's right. And now, I mean, that's partly because I just never know quite what will happen on the road. And, you know, I also want to have stuff with me. This is assuming that I've got a vehicle that I control and that I'm taking for the day. But You know, it might be that I get stuck. One time in Congo, I got stuck in a diamond mine overnight, and it would have been nice to have my gear with me. So I try to take as much as I can.
Even though you're packing very light, you do take a light blazer along.
Yeah, I mean, that's really because there is some chance I'll end up interviewing the president or prime minister. And so I try to have, you know, some clothes that are just, that won't get me totally driven out of the presidential palace.
Right.
So that's, you know, I don't take a tie, but I have some shirt that can be mildly, mildly passable, and usually some khakis and some shoes that aren't too disreputable.
But otherwise clothes that are security-minded, zippers, hidden pockets, and this kind of thing.
Correct. Yeah, I love some of these travel clothes that that have like hidden pockets. And I also carry, so I have a decoy wallet. So if somebody somebody asks for tries to rob me in my wallet, I can, you know, hand something over with just, you know, a small amount of money. But then I have usually my money and my passport in a little pouch that connects to my belt and then goes inside my pants. And, you know, I've had robbers like make me take off my shoes and socks and, you know, search me, but they've never discovered that pouch.
You probably have a need for lots of just cash. Do you bring a lot of cash when you travel?
I do because, of course, you know, credit cards aren't accepted and you often have to pay, you know, very large sums, you know, to hire a vehicle. Hotels tend to be very cheap, but vehicles and fuel tend to be often quite expensive.
Well, and, plus, there's other reasons. I mean, you wrote in your book, Chasing Hope, about bumping into somebody in Afghanistan, and what you had to bring them $60,000 in cash.
Yeah. So when the war was beginning in Afghanistan, I flew to Kabul. This is in 2001, right after Kabul had fallen from the Taliban. And so there were reporters coming in from around the country with the resistance, and they had run out of cash. And so I flew into Kabul on a UN flight with $60,000 in cash and a bunch of cameras and satellite phones for all of them. You know, I arrived at the airport and it was, I didn't know how to get from the airport safely to the New York Times bureau that had just been created. And I remember bargaining for ages to make it seem as if I was just incredibly impoverished and couldn't afford, you know, $50 to get into Kabul, because I didn't want to be seen to be, you know, worth robbing.
The last thing I want to talk about in your light packing bag is a tourniquet.
Yeah, that's because I've had friends who've been shot or injured in a limb and have bled out. And so a tourniquet is light. And if you are shot, or, you know, it could be a vehicle accident or something, but if you can apply that tourniquet or have somebody else know that it's in your bag and can apply it, that is truly life-saving.
So that could have saved their life, having a tourniquet and knowing how to use it.
Absolutely.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Nicholas Kristof. His new book is Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. And we're just reviewing a day in the life of a reporter far away as a foreign correspondent. Nick, as a journalist, there are hotels in conflict zones that are kind of the go-to place for journalists, I understand, right? And I'm always amazed at or impressed by the fact that journalists can gather together in relative safely in a conflict zone if they know which hotel to go to. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there have always been some hotels in Beirut and Somalia, in Haiti, that just build a reputation for making things work for journalists and solving their problems. Khartoum was another place. You know, sometimes it's that they pay off the local gangs to stay away. They will pay the telephone company to make sure that there are phone lines that get through, or telex lines, or internet. And in Beirut, the hotel, the Commodore Hotel, where the journalist stayed, they famously had a parrot that would do this incredible mime of a incoming mortar shell. And it would do this, and everybody would dive for the floor.
Just to get a reaction from the guests.
Yeah. Yeah, but the security is just paramount in those kind of situations, and you want to be absolutely sure that you've staying in a hotel where you're not going to be kidnapped and where you can be safe. And journalists are also pretty good in those situations, and when they're overcrowded and there's no room, then, you know, they open the door and let people sleep on the floor or any other place.
And from that base, you can go out and do your work and know you can come back and hopefully have a shower and a meal and find your luggage. It's so interesting to read about your experience as a foreign correspondent. One thing I really was struck with was how it is people that make your work sparkle, meeting people. And that's a big part of your work, and it involves a lot of people skills. I'd like to just wrap up our conversation with, you wrote about, you got yourself into one situation where you had to say, please, don't slaughter a goat on my account.
This was in Darfur, and I was reporting there in Sudan, and I don't eat meat. I'm a vegetarian. And, you know, the problem is you arrive in some poor village, and the village is kind of honored by your arrival, and they feel the need to welcome you and give you gifts and feed you and to, you know, slaughter a goat. And they couldn't afford a goat.
Right.
And so, you know, it would have been worse if they had, because then I would have felt some obligation to eat.
Yeah.
Eat it when I'm a vegetarian.
You know,
so I was like begging them, no, don't. And so instead they gave me some fufu, the local grain staple.
Yeah.
And so I solemnly ate that, wondering if it was going to make me sick, but it didn't.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, just, again, a tribute to the hospitality that people have shown me all over the world, and often, you know, taken risks to keep me alive during my reporting.
Yeah. Oh, that is such a powerful, deep-seated need, is to be hospitable to foreign guests. I mean, in Latin America, this mi casa, su casa, my house is your casa, your house, is taken literally from people who are very, very poor. And of course, across Islam, you know, devout Muslims really do believe that a guest from far away is a gift from God, and they treat us as such. Such a great opportunity you have to humanize this world through your work. And thank you for the passion you've brought to this.
Thank you. No, it's been great. And I, you know, you and I are both kind of in the travel business, and the opportunities you have to meet amazing people and see the world and learn from other countries about our own is really powerful.
Oh, yeah. It's just so important to get out there. You don't need to, you know, go to bed with your headlamp on, but you do get out of your comfort zone and see all these opportunities to learn as a way to realize that we got to learn to live together on this great planet. Nicholas Kristof, thanks for your work. Best wishes with your book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, and happy travels.
Great to be with you, Rick.
You can read what Nick Kristof has to say about the world twice a week in the New York Times. And we have links to his earlier appearances with us in our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. A British journalist joins us next. John Ellich writes with an eye on our cities and how we organize our world. He's looked at why today's national borders look the way they do and writes about it in A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. He tells us about it next on Travel with Rick Steves.